country's internal affairs, both in the civilian and military spheres.
The U.S. military-industrial complex has a long history of interference in other countries, including Pakistan. Back in 1958, the notorious American spy agency, CIA, engineered the first military coup in Pakistan, which ended 11 years of civilian rule in the South Asian country. It brought to power a U.S.-friendly military dictator, General Ayub Khan. That set a dangerous precedent and paved the path for subsequent military coups. The country's 75-year history has been marked by multiple military coups, corruption scandals, and political infighting. U.S. interests in Pakistan have primarily been influenced by the country's strategic location. In the 1950s and 1960s, Pakistan was made part of the U.S.-led Cold War alliances to contain the communists because of its location close to the southern reaches of the Soviet Union. In the 1980s, Pakistan was used by Americans to overthrow the Soviet regime in neighboring Afghanistan because of their geographical proximity. After the events of 9/11, Americans again roped in Pakistan to fight Al-Qaeda and the Taliban. The 20-year military adventure turned into a big disaster. Over the years, rulers in Pakistan maintained close ties with the U.S. for their survival and to keep the funds flowing. That proved to be Imran Khan's undoing, as he took a different path and tried to assert his independence.
The overthrow of the Imran Khan government in Pakistan and the ensuing political crisis has many external dimensions. The recent developments in Afghanistan and Ukraine led to an escalation of tensions between Washington and Islamabad, and Khan's calculated move to forge stronger alliances with regional powers, China and Russia. The new coalition government led by Shehbaz Sharif, who is considered close to the military establishment, is likely to repair Pakistan's ties with the U.S. in a way that relations with countries like Russia and China not to be affected.
Imran Khan rose to fame in the 1980s as a flamboyant cricketer. He led Pakistan to the historic World Cup victory in 1992. Like on the cricket field, Khan asserted himself in politics as well. He was scathing in his criticism of America's military adventure in Afghanistan, which he deemed unwinnable. In July last year, he censured Washington for the mess it was leaving behind in the war-ravaged country. He also refused to allow Pakistan to be used for so-called over-the-horizon U.S. military operations. That obviously ruffled feathers in the U.S. More recently, Khan refused to condemn Russia's military operation in Ukraine. He was in Moscow hours before Russian President Vladimir Putin announced the operation, raising eyebrows in the West. His tenure also saw the strengthening of Pakistan's ties with China, a country that continues to challenge America's global hegemony. In February, Khan held talks with Chinese leader Xi Jinping and underscored that China was Pakistan's steadfast partner, a staunch supporter and iron brother. The new premier and Pakistan Muslim League chief, Shehbaz Sharif, is likely to adopt a different approach by mending ties with the U.S. He recently stirred up a controversy with his beggars can't be choosers remarks in the context of relations between Pakistan and the U.S. But experts believe that Pakistan's growing ties with China and Russia are unlikely to be affected.
Now, to have more insight, we are joined by Mr. Saptain Ahmed Dar, Pakistani academic and political analyst at the University of Lahore. Welcome to the program, sir. Let's begin with Imran Khan's claim of a U.S. conspiracy to overthrow his democratically elected government. So, what do you think are America's interests in Pakistan?
Thank you, Mehdi, for inviting me to your show. Well, geopolitically, American interest in South Asia, specifically in the region of Afghanistan and Pakistan, since past 20 years is determined by the war on terror and its objectives in this region. We see that since 20 years, it has been engaging Pakistan in relation to their power military apparatus in Afghanistan to eradicate terrorism. This is why they have this, you know, mantra of Pakistan doing more in order to eradicate the terrorism. But unfortunately, United States has not been realizing that after 2001, when 9/11 incident took place, our interests were not aligned. This is very technical because the same people who United States used with the help of us in Afghanistan to stop the army of the Soviets were pitted against us after 2001, and Pakistan was forced to fight their own brothers, which is not possible. And United States do not understand this. This is why Pakistan has been called that it is playing double game with the United States, because while they are receiving aid through the surrender and appeasement model, they are not using it to fight the people in Afghanistan, which they call terrorists. But the truth is that the United States do not want to see an Islamic fundamentalist government taking form in any Muslim country. So to me, the interest of the United States in Afghanistan and Pakistan has always been in relation to military security. And this is why the bone of contention still remains in between them. And there is a transition that is taking place, which I don't see that things will get, you know, better for both of the countries, unfortunately.
Mr. Ahmed, many trace the U.S. military-industrial complex's interference in Pakistan to the 1958 military coup that ended 11 years of civilian rule and installed the first military dictatorship. So what's your take on this?
The interference, Mahdi, you know, started way back, even in the, it's a declassified document now. We can search it on Google that when Pakistan, you know, was headless, because for almost 7 years to 8 years, we were not having any constitution, and the sovereign head of Pakistan was Queen Elizabeth II. In that period, you know, Liaquat Ali Khan became the Prime Minister of Pakistan, and he was asked when he visited the Kansas City University, and he asked for United States assistance, because at that time, our Majlis-e-Shura declared that Soviet Union cannot be a strategic ally of Pakistan because of its communist agenda, and they do not believe in any monotheistic or any polytheistic religion, because their religion is money and socialism. So it was quite, you know, effective to have United States as their partner, but that relation was meant to have, you know, equality. It was not, you know, meant to have a certain relation in which Pakistan would be in dependency syndrome. Well, that dependency syndrome came when after Liaquat Ali Khan declared that the world would be a limpid leg if United States is not going to help states like Pakistan. Well, United States agreed to it because it had, you know, its Bretton Woods agenda in 1945, when it wanted to have newly emerging nation states more in their club, where, you know, they would have, you know, the superiority of their U.S. dollar. And eventually, through that, they would access the markets of these newly emerging states. So United States came and said to Liaquat Ali Khan that they want military bases so that they can spy against the Soviets. Liaquat Ali Khan refused that. And he eventually paid the price when he was assassinated. And it is quite evident now with the declassified documents that he was eliminated by the United States.
Now, Mr. Ahmed, let's come back to Imran Khan again. Do you think his bold and brave stance on America's unwinnable war in Afghanistan, a NATO-provoked conflict in Ukraine, and warm ties with China proved his undoing?
Yes, maybe you are rightly asking this question, because Imran Khan has always been the only leader in Pakistan who is compelling the public that Afghanistan war is an unwinnable war through military actions. You have to talk with those people because they have the tribal system in them. And, you know, the peace resolution will always come through talks. So this, the idea of, you know, having peace in the region has not been welcomed by the United States, because, you know, they always say that, you know, Pakistan has to do more in relation to military action against their very own brothers in Afghanistan. But we know the truth, that all the proxies that has destabilized Afghanistan and Pakistan were and still being created by the United States secretly, and there is a hidden role of the State of Israel and India and Afghanistan to contain the nuclear Pakistan, because as long as Pakistan is a nuclear power, a Muslim country, state like State of Israel cannot encompass major states, Muslim states, and expand their territory in the Middle East, which is their hidden strategic agenda in the Middle East. So this is why Imran Khan is not suitable as a prime minister of Pakistan because of his Islamic fundamentalist policy. Because Mahdi, you know, it's all about, you know, the wars against the governor system. They do not want to see any model thriving in any part of the Muslim world that, you know, challenges the hegemony of the Westphalian model. So this is why it was very important to conspire against Imran Khan by using the opposition members who have no confidence vote, and the strategy of using horse trading to buy the votes were used by the United States through their stooges in Pakistan to oust Imran Khan. And unfortunately, they have become successful enough.
There you have it, Mr. Ahmed Dar, Pakistani academic and political analyst at the University of Lahore. So glad to have you with us, sir. Now let's see how people have reacted on social media.
Shirin Mazari, human rights minister in the Imran Khan government, says people of Pakistan have rejected the imported government brought in by the US-initiated regime change conspiracy. Travel blogger and social media influencer Tehsin Bajwa notes that the way the nation is standing with Imran Khan is unprecedented in Pakistan's history, referring to massive public rallies in support of Khan in Lahore. M.Q. Khan, a lawyer and writer, says he is attending a political gathering first time in his life, and the reason is the American conspiracy against Imran Khan's government.
You're listening to The Subcontinent, broadcast by IRIB English Radio. This weekly program reviews ongoing developments in India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh. Listen to The Subcontinent every Monday here on IRIB English Radio.
Amidst rapidly changing regional dynamics and the emergence of new alliances, India as a key player is being courted by major Western and Eastern powers. In the wake of Russia's military operation in Ukraine, a stream of foreign dignitaries has made whirlwind trips to New Delhi in recent weeks. Delegations have come from the US, Australia and Japan, India's Quad partners, as well as from Russia and China, amid hectic efforts to bolster their respective power blocs. Now, what has sparked concern in the West is India's neutral stand on Ukraine.
As the Ukraine war rages on, new global alliances are taking shape. Some countries have chosen to support Ukraine, some have thrown their weight behind Russia, and some others, like India, have decided to remain neutral. Efforts to court the Narendra Modi-led government in New Delhi continue. Russia's Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov visited India on March the 31st, the same day as British Foreign Secretary Liz Truss. A day earlier, U.S. Deputy National Security Advisor Dalip Singh was in the Indian capital. A week before that, Australian Prime Minister Scott Morrison and Modi held a virtual summit, and China's Foreign Minister Wang Yi paid a surprise visit to New Delhi. Japanese Premier Fumio Kishida also held talks with Modi, and so did US President Joe Biden. India's heavy reliance on Russian arms has prevented it from joining its Quad QUAD partners and condemning Kremlin's military operation in Ukraine. New Delhi has also kept up oil imports from Russia in defiance of U.S. warnings. At the same time, the Chinese top diplomat's visit to New Delhi has opened doors for Modi to attend this year's BRICS summit in China, where a Russia-India-China trilateral meeting is likely to take place. So the jury is still out on whether India is to join the Russia-China camp or continue to sit on the fence with its feet on the Western playfield.
In our judgment, it is important that all countries, especially those with leverage, press Putin to end the war. And it's also important that democracies stand together and speak with one voice to defend the values that we share.
India's growing dependence on Russian arms and cheap crude oil has distanced it from the waning imperial power, the United States, putting the strategic ties on a sticky wicket. Surprised by New Delhi's bold stance on the Ukraine conflict and the continued import of Russian crude, Biden administration officials have warned India and some other countries of potential consequences. But that hasn't deterred New Delhi, which sees Moscow as an indispensable partner.
In a terse warning to India and other countries that have rebuffed Washington's calls to condemn Russia's military operation in Ukraine, U.S. Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen on April the 13th said they will face the consequences. She said the U.S. and its allies will not be indifferent to countries that have shied away from taking a pro-West position on the simmering Ukraine conflict in a fiery salvo aimed at India. Her remarks came days after President Joe Biden warned India that buying more oil from Russia was not in the South Asian country's interests. He said only India among the Quad countries was somewhat shaky in acting against Russia. He later dialed Indian Premier Narendra Modi, warning him that it was not in New Delhi's interests to boost energy imports from Moscow.
We can truly assert that there's virtually no domain on which we are not cooperating with each other. The nature of our opportunities and challenges are such that they are more effectively addressed through a cross-cutting dialogue.
As it appears, the war in Ukraine has exposed deep fault lines in America's relations with India, which have primarily centered on defense and security cooperation. While the two countries share concerns over China's staggering rise and the threat it poses to them, they are not on the same page on other issues. Also, there appears to be a growing realization in India that the U.S. is an unreliable partner.
Now, to talk more on this issue, we are joined by Dr. Ranjit Berar, political analyst from London. Now, new global alliances are taking shape in the wake of the Ukraine conflict, prompting both Western and Eastern powers to court India. Now, Mr. Berar, do you think India will join any camp, or will it maintain its neutrality?
Mehdi, it's a really interesting question. Anyone who has studied the history of India will know that post its independence, it, of course, was a colonial vassal state of England and achieved independence in 47. And in that post-colonial era, it was a key member of the non-aligned movement. But strategically, it was always very close to the Soviet Union and has remained close in many respects to Russia. And that includes in terms of its military spending, military contracts and military hardware. It has had a historically very close position to Russia, and still more than perhaps 60% or 70% of its military hardware is still of Russian manufacture. And it has an important relationship with Russia, both economically but also militarily. Now, when it joined the Quad, and with the rise of its new BJP Prime Minister Modi, it was seen to make steps to move closer to the United States. And this worried me deeply, that it seemed to be essentially joining the camp of the United States, of United States imperialism. But it seems to have rode back with a couple of very serious steps. One economic, just before the turn of the new year, so in, I think, December 2021, India and Russia signed a very important landmark historic agreement that they would now trade using the currencies of the ruble and the rupee, so trade directly internationally in their own currencies. And this is a very important step for two such large and important economies, in order to bypass what has currently and for the last period historically been the hegemony of the petrodollar economy and of the dollar as the international reserve currency and hence of the hard globally traded currency that allows it as a fiat currency to flout many of the normal rules that would apply to other countries, and therefore sees other countries have to accept unfavorable terms.
Dr. Berar, you mentioned Russia's importance. Now, India refused to condemn Russia's military operation in Ukraine and defied U.S. warnings to cut import of crude oil from Moscow. So how important is Russia for India's defense and energy sectors?
So as we were discussing, I think it's very important, both for India's defence, but probably more for its defence than its energy sector per se. India has its own sources of energy. But, you know, in a world where energy is increasing sharply in price, and energy security is key to the whole of one's economic development and strategy, the energy does matter. And India has recently signed an important contract with Russia to buy Russian gas and oil and coal, and to do so in the currency of the ruble and the rupee. And this will be, you know, not to the liking of the United States, but much to the advantage economically, both of India and of course, of Russia.
Dr. Brar, U.S. Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen warned India and other countries of consequences for rebuffing Washington's call to take a pro-West stand on the Ukraine conflict. Now, the question is, will India be deterred by this?
Well, there were questions regarding this in the Congress, in the Indian National Parliament, Indian ministers were in fact interrogated. Modi refused, in fact, to meet with Victoria Nuland when she did her tour, trying to reinforce support for United States policy, which is to use Ukraine as a proxy to wage war upon Russia. Modi surprised me by refusing to meet with her, refusing to be treated as a vassal of the United States. And in fact, his deputy prime minister, who answered questions on the floor of the House, said that she didn't dare to directly raise questions of trade with him. And in fact, they are not amenable to being told how to act. Now, clearly, Imran Khan in Pakistan has essentially been toppled from government, yes, by the military, yes, by the opposition, but at the behest of the United States for exercising this kind of, disregard to American foreign policy. But India is a large country. Pakistan is large, has 220 million population, but India has 1.4 billion population and is not likely ordered around. So I've been pleasantly surprised by the independent stance of the Modi administration in this regard.
On that note, I would like to thank Dr. Brar for being on the program. Hope to have you again. Now let's see some reactions by people on social media.
Author Martin Jacques points to the refusal of India, China and Pakistan to vote against Russia and Chinese foreign ministers' visit to New Delhi, adding that Quad without India means US and two of its vassal states. Monica Verma, a strategic affairs analyst, says India refused to succumb to Japan's pressure on Ukraine, while arguing that New Delhi must pursue its self-interest without pandering to any diplomatic club. Author and commentator Brahma Chelani remarks that the US has made Russia the central target of its foreign policy, and Biden is insisting that friends like India also join the gang against Moscow.
And that was our episode on the U.S. meddling in Pakistan and the external elements of Imran Khan's ouster, and also how the world powers are trying to court India amid the Ukraine conflict. We shall meet again next week. So till then, take good care.
This is A to Z. An Introduction to Islamic Lifestyle. Today's lesson: the characteristics of mystical fasting. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the Most Beneficent, the Most Merciful. Dear brothers and sisters, Assalamu alaikum. Peace and blessings of Allah be upon you all. This is A to Z, coming to you from IRIB English Radio, and I'm your host, Ali. Brothers and sisters, we know that there are different levels of fasting. There's a bare bones level, the basic level, which is for, let's say, the converts or you know, the younger generation who are just starting to keep their fasting. That's called the jurisprudential level. Then the higher level to that is the ethical level, where, you know, you go a step further. And those vices which don't necessarily invalidate the fast, you stay away from those vices too. And also you think about the philosophy of fasting, why you have been prescribed to keep fast. The third and the highest level that we mentioned is the mystical fasting. And this is where your end goal is none other than Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. And the urafa and the mystics of Islam and, you know, Ahlul Bayt alayhi salatu wassalam, those are the people, the noble, sincere servants of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala who keep that fast. Today we want to discuss the characteristics of mystical fasting. Well, these people who keep mystical fasting, they don't even think of disobedience of Allah, right? Performing an act of disobedience is different. They don't even think of it. The thought of disobeying Allah itself is a no-go area for them. It is a restricted area. Fasters who are not many at this degree believe you are what you think, and hence they fast from all other than Allah. That includes paradise. A faster at this stage, since he or she is fasting from other than Allah, deserves to be his guest in his month. This status is called in Islamic mysticism assimilation in Allah, al-fana' fillah, which is the ultimate purpose of servitude to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. So you can well imagine how high this level of fasting would be. Welcome back to your listeners. Today we are discussing the characteristics of mystical fasting, which is the highest level of fasting in Islam. To this end, Muslim mystics consider fasting even greater than prayers, in that the devotee, during his prayers, needs to engage his organs, which in a sense means engagement within the self, whereas fasting is equal to refraining and detachment and requires no engagement. So see how this third and the highest level is very special, and only the special servants of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala get to keep a fast which can be qualified to be a mystical fasting. Mystical fasting is not something that can be achieved overnight. You know, sometimes, unfortunately, you know, because of our shallow understanding of Islam, we believe that such a level of fasting can be acquired very easily, or, you know, through some rituals or through some acts. It's not like that. It's a state of mind. It's a state of heart. It's a state of your soul. It's a spiritual state that you go in, and that's where you're fasting. Now, how to explain and elaborate on it further, it's the job of the mystics themselves. We can only talk about the superficial characteristics of such a fasting. It is generally a process. It's not overnight, generally speaking. You know, you can't just, oh, this is my first Ramadan, and in this month, I'm just going to keep all of my fasts to be the mystical fasting. Well, it's not that simple, brothers and sisters. Allah takes his pious, sincere, and selfless servants to this level. It's not something that can be easily achieved through some do's and don'ts. But we just wanted to bring it up so we are all aware of the different levels of fasting. Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, thank you very much for staying with us till the end of today's episode of A to Z. Don't forget to log on to our website at parstoday.com, Call of Islam page. We leave you all in the care of Allah. Till next time, والسلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Seeing the Canadian government's response to what's been happening in Palestine these last few weeks confirms that Canadians do live in a sick society. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Paul Salvatore, journalist. This article is published under the heading Canada is a sick society for as long as it supports Israeli regime terror. Here's more on the issue. Seeing the Canadian government's response to what's been happening in Palestine these last few weeks confirms that Canadians do live in a sick society. In those weeks, near 20 Palestinians killed, thousands more terrorized at Al-Aqsa Mosque during a violent raid in Gaza bombed by Israeli regime forces. Not a word, let alone an official statement or press release from Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau. Disgusting about this is that, despite the silence on Palestine, he did reaffirm his commitment to the Canadian Charter of Rights and Freedoms, including to Canadian Indigenous peoples. There is just no way he can be serious. When you care about human rights in any genuine sense, you've deep and universal concern for it. And you don't, in words and actions, simply extend such rights when it's easy or convenient, when it gains you favor and support. Thank you. The Canadian government is helping the Zionist regime's first Prime Minister David Ben-Gurion's mission to eliminate Palestine. He describes the mission in the well-known 1937 letter he wrote in his son, quote, "We must expel Arabs and take their place. Up to now, all our aspirations have been based on an assumption, one that has been vindicated throughout our activities in the country, that there is enough room in the land for the Arabs and ourselves. But if we are compelled to use force not in order to dispossess the Arabs of the Negev or Transjordan, but in order to guarantee our right to settle there, our force will enable us to do so," unquote. Many Canadians, in solidarity with Palestine, are demanding this end, but it's as if the government never bears them. Instead, in contempt of international law and morality, it keeps supporting the Zionist regime, including exporting arms to this regime's military. The government's message is clear. Israel is the friend and Palestine is not. We want you to go along with the ethnic cleansing of Palestine as if that's normal, part of what is to be Canadian and embodied by the example of Prime Minister Justin Trudeau never condemning the fake regime of Israel for all the horror it inflicts. Perhaps the Canadian government is afraid that if they condemn the Zionist regime, they, even though that is in keeping with Canada's expressed commitment to human rights, will be met with a predictable criticism by Israeli supporters, and that's being anti-Semitic. And of course, they don't want that reputation. People realize that to fight for Palestinian justice is to care for humanity. Dovetailing with precepts such as saying no to murder and colonization of religions around the world. The Sikh Society of Canada identified extends to the callous disregard the Canadian government on top of failing to intervene in the ethnic cleansing of Palestine shows Palestinian Canadians. They are suffering tremendously, seeing from afar. Geographically, the murder, bombing, and disposition of Palestinians on a routine basis. The government, however, much as they protest, do nothing substantial about it. What's perhaps most maddening about it is that it is casual, done as if there is nothing serious to worry or be alarmed about. It recalls philosopher Hannah Arendt's observations of Adolf Eichmann during the Nuremberg trials, who described his role as a Nazi killer nonchalantly. The Canadian government's attitude towards Palestine is equally as reprehensible. It is ultimately one of indifference, sparing no urgent action on the part of elected officials to end the Israeli regime brutality. They are a terrorist regime, and much as they may be a friend or ally to Prime Minister, they are not to people. People who refuse to support, let alone turn a blind eye to a Sikh society, a Sikh Canadian society.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really in fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. This is your host, Musa Al-Bahadli, and you are now listening to the program, Islamic upbringing. In this program, you will discuss issues, relevant questions, and other fields regarding the Islamic upbringing of children. And we would like to stress that the answers that we provide in this program are all based upon the narrations of the household of the Prophet and, of course, of the Prophet himself, and upon the Holy Quran, supplemented with scientific research. Joining us in the studio today is our dear friend, Sheikh Ali Himani, who is an Islamic researcher at the Seminary of Qum. Dear Sheikh, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, and thank you for joining us.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah. It's my pleasure to be here in your studio.
Sheikh, today we will be talking about, again, how we can manage our tweens and teenagers, and hopefully so that we may guide them towards an Islamic upbringing and an Islamic life. Because Islam, it isn't just a part of our life, it is our life. So, Sheikh, would you say that inviting, incising our children to come to Islam and be more religious, and religiousness in general, is also a good method of guidance?
Very true, because if you remember our discussion that's heading towards how to manage these energies that are bubbling into them,
right,
the high adrenaline
program,
and
right,
all that. So one of the ways is to introduce religion, introduce religiousness, and introduce religious activities for them so that they get involved into these spiritual and religious activities emotionally, physically, logically.
Right.
When I say emotionally, physically, and logically, I purposefully mention these three terms here. Let's start with physical set of activities. Take your children to the community centers and get them to volunteer to do certain things. You know, clean up the place or vacuum the place or,
right,
you know,
the mosques,
set it up,
right,
or the mosques.
At
set
least
it up.
Participate in the
Correct.
Activities.
And then you have different programs during the various months. For example, the month of Muharram, the month of
right,
Ramadan. So at the time of Iftari, when people come together for breaking their fast, let them volunteer, go around, distribute, you know, the dates or the salt,
right,
or whatever. Let them take up some physical activity which is related to the religion.
Right.
Let them be physically involved in various activities. Let them wash the dishes at the end of the... Let them,
right,
you know, gather all the stuff, or someone manage the mic system, or someone manage the audiovisual
right,
projector. Some activity where they start feeling attached and the sense of responsibility towards that community. So they have this responsibility. I am managing the mic system here. And
right,
people recognize me, because at that age, they want to get recognized.
Recognition, right,
right. So this is one way, the physical element, taking them, getting them involved physically into various religious activities, giving awan, reciting Quran, and all this.
Right.
Emotionally, what I mean is getting them involved into recitations. You know, the eulogies at the beginning of the program, Ziyarat-e Ashura, supplications,
right,
Ziyarat-e Ashura, and different things, Hadith-e Kissa, and all that stuff, so that they read and then they translate, they understand, and then there's an emotional buildup and emotional attachment in them towards the Islam, especially the eulogies where they recite the musiba and the challenges and the difficulties that Imam Hussein alayhi salam had to face in the battlefield
right,
of Karbala. And this is where they realize that all that Imam Hussein alayhi salam has sacrificed for them to continue on the straight path. So there's an emotional attachment happening here.
Right, let's go ahead and take a quick break.
Break and come back. And
right, yeah, that would be good.
This is Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Contact us at EnglishRadio@irib.ir.
Welcome back, dear listeners. You are now listening to the program Islamic Upbringing. Dear Sheikh, just before we went on a break, you were saying that we need to get our children involved in religion physically, emotionally, and also
logically. Okay, so emotionally, physically, and logically.
Right.
Now, why do I want this logical element? And according to me, it's one of the most important elements.
Yeah, what do you mean when you say logically?
Logically.
Involved? Right.
the religion should not appeal to them at emotional level only. It should appeal to their logic. It should appeal to their common sense. It should make sense to them.
So pure reasoning and all that.
Pure reasoning. Right. It is only then that they will be convinced and they will remain steadfast and focused on the path of
religion. Because the mind and reason, it is the essence of our faith, of our iman.
Exactly. And today, the curriculum system, you know, I don't know how many parents actually look at what is being taught to their kids in their school and colleges and open their books and look at it like what is being taught. I rarely think, very few parents are really deeply interested in what is being taught to them in the college. But the children, the teenagers, the youth are being taught questions and doubts pertaining to their religion. Like, religion is opium, you know, there's a very famous statement. So they're being taught that these are fancy stuff, mythologies, you know, and it's good
to have liberalism instead.
Correct.
And, capitalism, all of these ideologies.
And they say that this is the real world. And what you're talking about, religion, is all fantasy. It's, you know, sci-fi. So good to have, but not necessarily practical.
Yes.
So here we need to use our logical proofs that are there as part of our religion that proves that there is a God and there has to be a God, the necessity of it. And what kind of a God is it? Is it an infinite God? Is it a finite God? Does it necessarily need to have a body? All those proofs, when you explain it to them logically, rationally, and you know, making appealing to their common sense, and if they're convinced about it, then they'll remain on the path of religion.
Because it is based upon reasoning and not just emotions and faith, blind faith.
And this is where it plays a great role, that when they go to school, when they go to college, they might not be able to answer back to their professor or a teacher, but deep down inside, they know that what I believe in is the eternal truth.
They
will
conviction.
Not leave that path.
Right.
So that's why at this age, we need to provide answers.
But how do we do that? Because many parents in this day and age, they are not themselves knowledgeable about these things. They were raised in an Islamic way, and that's why they are, unfortunately, or a good thing, they are Muslims. Not because they sat down one day and they were like in deep in thought about who is God and why God and all that kind of stuff. So how should we teach the teenagers this?
I can suggest two ways here. One, that the parents themselves take up the responsibility to read some material.
So educate themselves first,
right? And I have come across parents who say that, you know, if an Islamic book is more than 50 pages, I'm not going to read it, right?
That's not a very good mindset, I would say.
That's not a good mindset. On the contrary, I asked this parent that, have you read Harry Potter? And like, yes, all the 7 volumes. And I'm like, that's 600 pages each volume. So you've read
the Lord of the Rings, like, God have mercy.
you've read thousands of pages of fantasy and novels and stories.
But that's okay.
That's okay. Right. And for religion, you're not willing to do that? And like, no, it's so boring and all that. Now, the challenge is that if parents don't educate themselves, they will not be able to guide and educate the children. So this is first way.
Right.
We'll deal with that.
Let's take the next step, dear Sheikh, after a quick break.
Ya muqdi al-khayrat, ya muqdi al-khayrat.
The Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alihi wa sallam said, the best among you is he who learns the Quran and teaches it.
Welcome back to your listeners of IRIB English Radio. You are now listening to the program Islamic Upbringing. Dear Sheikh, just before we went on a break, we were discussing the ways that we can make our teenagers, make our young, engage their minds logically in religion. How that they may build their iman, their faith, their conviction through logical means. Now, we said the first step to do that was for the parents themselves, first of all, to educate themselves.
Correct.
Now, what about the second step, Desha?
Right. Let me just complete that first part, that if if the parents don't educate themselves, even if we look at the second step, the parents have to educate themselves even in that scenario, because if they don't educate themselves, they'll end up countering or conflict. They'll end up with conflicting views, particularly the children. So the first way is the parents should read themselves and educate themselves. If they can't do that, then get a scholar, invite a scholar to your community center on regular days to come and give a half an hour lecture.
To preach.
to preach, right? What do? We invite the scholar only during the month of Maha Ramadan. And
That's the season.
And
When we need to cry and after we fasted for a month.
And Maha Muharram. So you call them for the month of Maha Ramadan where they come for 10 days, that especially the Shab-e Qadr and all that.
Right.
And then he'll talk about Shab-e Qadr and its importance and certain points and the sawab and the amal of Shab-e Qadr. And it's all done, packed up, gone.
See you next year.
See you next year. And there's nothing about aqayat, the belief system and the proof of God, nothing being discussed there.
Theological beliefs, the logical reasons,
proofs and reasoning, and rational discussions, nothing happening there. In Maha Muharram, there are certain discussions, but not into the necessary depth that is required by the youth and teenagers today. Superficially touching upon it and then getting into the musibah of Imam Hussain alayhi salam. And this is where the parents or the community leaders should invite the scholars on the regular ordinary days or during these special days and tell them.
Like a weekly program every
weekend. A weekly program. Or even in these special occasions, invite them and tell them, please talk about the rational reasoning that'll convince our teenagers.
Make a curriculum.
Make a curriculum.
You start from A to all the way to Z.
To Z. So that my son, when he listens to your 20 lectures during Maha Muharram or 15 lectures during Maha Ramadan, he should be convinced that God exists and the God that is infinite, Hakim,
he should be steadfast
wise,
in his faith.
Omnipotent and all that
all
should get
attributes.
Ingrained.
Exactly. So this suggestion is in essence that we should establish a curriculum.
Curriculum and invite the right scholars.
Of course.
And not just send the children. The parents should also attend this program.
They may benefit too as well.
More than benefit. Because when the son listens to this program, comes back to the father and says, Dad, this is what the scholar has been saying. What do you think? And he goes blank. Have no idea. And like, what? You want me to follow something that you don't follow? You want me to believe in something that you've never heard of? If I want to counter question and discuss, you have no idea what we're discussing. When my father doesn't believe in something, why should I?
But when he is involved, on the other hand.
Exactly. So the father should also attend the program. The mother should also attend the program. The son should also attend the program. The daughter should also attend
the program. Lead by
example. And during the dinner, ask your kids. So this is what Maulana was saying today. This is what the scholar was saying today. Do you have a point to counter it? Can you defend that? I say this is wrong. Involve them into a discussion.
We call this a mubahatha for, us as students, as scholars.
Exactly.
We do this,
so
right.
Involve him logically.
Yes.
Encourage him to use his reasoning. Encourage him to use his common sense.
Engage him.
Engage him. And this is where he will be convinced about the faith and the belief system. And he will remain steadfast on it and not get
also, this is where we clarify all these doubts that may have arisen
and
questions.
So when he goes back to his education system, to his college, to his university, among his atheist friends, and they start attacking him, he might not be able to defend all the way.
Right.
Or maybe even be able to defend. But at least he will not become mutazalzil and
not be
shaky.
Shaken. Right. No, he has a solid background.
Correct. So these are some of the ways to use to attain what you've requested for.
Now, Sheikh, unfortunately, we are out of time, as I would love to continue this discussion, but inshallah, we will continue it on another day.
Inshallah.
I thank you for contributing to this discussion and also thank the dear listeners for tuning in. If our dear listeners have any suggestions, feedback, or some comments, please contact us at our email, englishradio@irib.ir. Alternatively, you can also visit our website, parstoday.com. You can also find us on various social media websites, such as on Twitter and Instagram, under the call handle of Call of Islam Radio. Thank you for tuning in.
Do you know what Islam says? It says that life's the greatest test. It says that life's a borrowed space, returned upon rest.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. 25 meters, 11,865 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iran Sat or Bat 5 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.